Yeah. Hello!
Hey! Hello!
And welcome to Liars League, where writers write, actors read, audience listens, and everybody wins. Be you roundhead or cavalier, we have five stories for you on this, our royalty and revolution themed Coronation Chicken Special. We'll have three tales by royal appointment in our first half, followed by a truly revolting interval, before we return with the rabble of the infamous Liars League book quiz. And a restored pair, a king and queen, or perhaps comrade and comrade, of rebellious stories to round out the night. Now, some of you, no doubt, have God Save the King as your ringtone. Some of you might have Billy Idol's Rebel Yell. Be that as it may, we don't want to hear any of them during the readings. So please, join the majority and turn your mobile phones to silent, to off, and we'll begin. Our first story will be The Princess and the Kennel. The Princess and the Kennel Girl by Fiona Mosman, read by Patsy Prince. Fiona is a writer from the Scottish Highlands who works as a librarian in Edinburgh. Her writing is often inspired by fables and folklore, folktales, and has appeared in the Bureau Dispatch, Windgraph, and the creative series from the Scottish Mountaineering Press has been nominated for Best Small Fictions 2023. Patsy trained at RADA and KCL and is currently the face of National Rail, but don't hold that against her. Recent film includes The Bad Nun, Mummy Reborn and Culture Shock. Theatre include Misfits at the Space Theatre, Voices from September 11th, The Old Pit, and Swallows at OFS Theatre Oxford. She also co-hosted Open, a podcast on the women's radio station. An ex-lawyer, ex-parliamentary candidate and ex-hotelier, Patsy is now excelling at being a bad wife, drinking too much gin, and expanding her collection of millinery. Patsy!
By Fiona Mosman. There was once a princess in a high, far, wintry kingdom who had a very strange gift that some called a curse. It was on account of this that the princess was locked away, her contact with other people forbidden, and gloves of the most curious kinds ordered for her from the lands to the south, where costly materials were woven by many skilled artisans, softer and kinder than the rough wools of that mountainous kingdom. The princess was treated well and wanted for nothing, but her heart was sore from loneliness. She could often be seen at the window of her high tower, talking to the birds and to the air. The folk in the fields below saw her and looked down again to their work. "'Tis a shame," one would say at length. "A crying shame," the other would agree. And they would work on together in silence, both holding in their mind the vision of that lovely young woman with her long hair and sorrowful bearing. The princess found company in the animals of the castle, and once a week her father, the king, would visit her for a game of chess. These visits were both a trial and a joy for her, for though she loved her father and he loved her, it was plain to both of them that she was not happy. With the animals, it was simpler. The birds tweeted and sang, making their curious little hops across her chamber, following the line of breadcrumbs she would set out for them. The dogs were even better, and gave her their whole hearts without question or hesitation. She was always careful to stroke them with her hands safely encased in the lavish gloves her father had provided. As far below the castle as the princess was high, in the kennels lower down the hillside, there lived a kennel girl. No one knew much about this kennel girl, for she was a quiet sort. But she was a good worker, and when she turned up in the middle of a harsh winter, two fine whippet dogs at her heels, and told the castle steward that she could work for her living if he would give her a place, and what with the last kennel girl marrying off last June and the dogs getting a bit neglected, the answer was an easy one. She was soon accepted as part of the background of the castle, old and crumbling though it was, and the dogs, traditionally kept for the hunt, but now, like their king, more inclined to rest and eat heartily, loved her well for her care of them. One day, the kennel girl received two messages. One was from her brother, and it was a letter which told her that her youngest sister had married, and pressed up between the pages was a dried flower from the bouquet she had held. The kennel girl recognised the flower as meadow sweet, so abundant in the southern kingdom where she was from. She propped the sprig up onto a windowsill and watched the light touch it. The second message came by runner, and it was a command from the king. The High King from the south will be proceeding to the Seven Kingdoms in the summer, it said. He will need a gift, and the king has determined that you are to breed the running dogs now, so that the best pup can be selected and given to the High King when he comes. The kennel girl was uneasy. In her time at the castle, none of the dogs had ever given birth. She suspected that many of them were too old for it now, and the two that she had from puppies had only ever miscarried. She'd been keeping this fact quiet, for it seemed that the royal dogs were as forgotten as she was. But now, it seemed not. The kennel girl went about her task, but with no success. Whatever she tried, the dogs would simply not fall pregnant. Late in the winter, as dirty snow was falling from the sky, the princess slipped away and came down to the kennels. "Why have the dogs been kept from me of late?" she asked, for she missed the visits that had been allowed of the dogs to her rooms. Kennel girl was close to tears as she explained the situation to the princess. "But you see, there's nothing I can do now," she said. If they do not breed soon, then the pups will not be born in time, and then I'm bound to be cast out." The princess felt the kennel girl's distress keenly. She slipped one hand out of her glove and laid it on the flank of one of the whippet dogs, a beautiful, creamy racer who regarded the princess with a limpid gaze and lay still, the only movement the rise and fall of her chest. The kennel girl looked at the princess, not seeing the other girl's fear and loneliness, but instead her courage, beauty, and a kind act that she did not fully understand. The princess met the kennel girl's eyes and gave a soft smile. "There, I have done what I can to help you," she said. Knowing that she had done not one but two forbidden things, the princess made haste back to her rooms. The kennel girl did not know what had changed, but days later, when it became plain that the cream-coloured whippet was pregnant, she concluded in wonder that it must have been the touch of the princess's hand. Not believing it, she began to watch the princess, and that was how she found that where the princess touched a bird, there grew new life, even out of season. And the plants that grew in the princess's chamber were always needing to be trimmed. They brimmed so with excess energy. She was filled with awe and tenderness, remembering the princess's words. It had been done to help her. To help her. And surely that was the reason for the princess's seclusion, with such a magnificent and dangerous gift. Then the kennel girl remembered the rumour of the princess's mother dying in childbirth, and how the king would not speak of it. And she wondered. As the weeks passed, the kennel girl tended to her dogs, and the princess kept to the high tower. The princess was sure the pregnancy was a safe one. She and the dog both wore expressions of contented wonder, such that others, seeing it, scoffed and muttered aloud that some folk had nothing better to do all day than sit around with their head in the clouds. Not that the kennel girl cared. Her mind was full of the promise of summer, all tangled together with that memory of the princess, her gloveless hand on the dog's flank, her eyes meeting the kennel girl's with that strange mixture of happiness and sadness. Now, when the kennel girl exercised the dogs, she did so in view of the tower. The castle bustled with preparations for the upcoming royal visit, and all the staff were in a state of excited anxiety. Only these two silent, secluded women seemed untouched. Occasionally, the kennel girl would pick up the dried meadow sweet from the windowsill and lift it to the horizon, picturing the fields full of wild flowers as they were in the south. The princess heard that her father had plans of marrying her to the High King's eldest son. And though when she was young, she had sometimes thought marriage might allow her the freedom she didn't have in her mountain home, now the thought sickened her. All her life, she'd had to keep herself in control, keep her gloves on, and stay in her room. Seeing the kennel girl surrounded by those dogs and full of life had made her yearn for something else. And every time she heard the servants talking about the miraculous pregnancy, and then the 7 strong newborn puppies, her heart skipped with guilt and joy. From the window of her high tower, she watched the kennel girl and her dogs, and the loneliness seemed a little less. One day, close to the High King's visit, the princess confronted the king. "Do you intend to marry me away?" she said. And she meant, "Do you intend to get rid of me so that I'm not your problem anymore?" "Yes," said the king. And what he meant was, "I do not want to lose you, my darling girl, but it's for your own good." They argued then, and it was a bitter quarrel that shocked the castle. They talked about it for days, how the princess, usually so meek, had stood her ground so strongly, and how the king had sat and said nothing, but had eventually commanded her to obey him, invoking the spectre of her dead mother. "'Tis a shame," they whispered, as they scrubbed the floors and prepared the food. "'Tis a crying shame." For though marrying the High King's eldest son was honourable, still they were fond of their beautiful princess and did not want her sent off to other lands where who knew what could happen to her. That night, the princess crept down to the kennels. She had with her a travelling bag and wore a warm cloak. The kennel girl let her into the dark warmth where the dogs and puppies were sleeping. My lady, the princess was flushed, kept wringing her gloved hands together. She had come to ask for help, but suddenly she wasn't sure that this was fair. Casting about the room, she saw the dried meadow sweet on the windowsill. I once helped you keep your post here, she said. But tonight, I had come to undo that work because now I am the one in need of help. So, please, take this and hear what I ask. And so saying, she removed her gloves and picked up the sprig from the sill. She gave the kennel girl the meadow sweet, and it was not a dried and fragranceless plant, but a living one with a scent like summer. The kennel girl took the bloom in amazement, thinking of what she had read between the lines of her brother's letter. Our sister has married and you have not. You are old, shriveled, dead, like this flower. Do not come home. These things and more had been said aloud after all. And now there was this girl, this princess, and her gift. Whatever you ask of me, I will give, she said. The princess smiled, and though the kennels were dark, it seemed like the moon shone brighter at that moment. My lady, I would do anything for you and go anywhere, said the kennel girl, for she had already realised why the princess was here. Even the grass worships you. I have seen it, and I will worship you too, if you will let me. You make me bold, and I shall ask what I came here to. But you must not worship me, for what I have is a curse. It is not, said the kennel girl, and she held the sprig of meadow sweet to her heart. She could see it, fields of it, spreading out before her, and the princess was with her too. It is a great gift. And then, growing uncertain, but I am unworthy. The princess saw that they were both of them certain in their love, and only unsure of whether they were worthy of its return. The instant of that knowledge, she stepped forward and took the kennel girl into her arms. Their kiss was tender and fierce and released the scent of meadowsweet. Let's go, she said, and took the kennel girl's hand. As they turned to leave, two girls and seven dogs and seven puppies in the last of winter's snow. New life was kindling where others had thought it barren and past time. But the time was ripe. The time was coming. Together, they walked to meet the summer.
Pat. Our second story will be Heads of State by Richie Jones, read by Nathaniel Ashley. Richie was born in Birkenhead and lives in North London. A lot of his fiction is concerned, one way or another, with the gap between these two places. His first novel, People from Good Homes, is currently seeking representation. Nate has featured in productions including Accidental Death of an Anarchist and Black Comedy, as well as part of the sketch company Edinburgh Review at the Monkey Bar. He's also done voiceover work and read one of his own short stories at a City Rights event. Nate!
Heads of State by Richie Jones. The boardroom had been prepared tastefully for the session with three representatives of what we refer to only as the state. lilies in vases either side of a large wall-mounted TV at one end of the room. The conference table, dark wood with a pleasing grain. Top-tier glassware. The room smells faintly of the lilies and nothing else. Behind us, the floor-to-ceiling window displays London in high resolution. There to be coveted. The clients sit facing the skyline. We've been extensively prepped on choreography this morning, the way we would deftly suggest where the clients should sit, without telling them where to sit, and with nothing so gauche as place settings. We are confident in our material, in the films and print ads and brochures and web pages that show how we will execute the marketing strategy we'd agreed upon months ago, although we were warned not to use the word execute in the room for obvious reasons. The trio of clients, all men, all wear navy suits. They are friendly, in the empty, magnanimous way of a winning tennis player, projecting this feeling with a high degree of technical skill, but no warmth. They are clearly capable of warmth, because when Francesca arrives, they are all over her. This dynamic slash of lime green and gold, who headhunted us all. The meeting begins with introductions, and again, we've been schooled on exactly how to describe ourselves and our roles for maximum utility and blandness. Worth paying for, but completely unmemorable. A phalanx. But still, someone must rise above. Look at Francesca. She was once, unimaginably, one of many. On the TV, a message from the leader of the state, a man we refer to only as the patron, a nickname used in his country by a grateful people. His voice is sonorous and light and somber and playful. The voice of God, or the voice your favourite pet would have if they could speak. No accent. The content is platitudinous, the value of our trusted partnership, etc. He never references human rights violations, for example, only ever alluding to international perception. The words are secondary to the image, because the first thing you notice about the patron is that he's handsome. Approachably so, friendly. Ethnically, he is white if you want him to be, brown if you want him to be. Like Jesus. He is dressed in a dove grey suit and a pair of white trainers, in a comfortable chair in a home that looks like it was carved from a single piece of marble. His hair shines. His smile shines too. Easy, boyish. Underneath the suit, you will find no fat whatsoever. It is hard to believe troubling reports from the region looking at that face. It is hard to believe Amnesty International when he smiles that smile. He is beautiful and has no idiosyncrasies. Your best-looking mate, not a monolithic figure capable of carrying legend and infamy across a dark century. No tiny moustache, for example. The image fades out, and we all look at each other and assume expressions of barely contained secular awe that we all practiced in the mirror this morning. Then our colleague, Oliver, rail thin from a training regime that involves a trapeze, stands and introduces the first cut of a promotional video we've been working on. Smiling children, welcoming uniformed staff, paddleboarders, silhouetted workers in straw hats, wizened hands reverently holding raw produce of some kind, sweeping drone shots of gleaming towers surrounded by striated blue water, young people with painted faces, culturally non-specific dancing, torches at dusk, satisfied faces illuminated by a crackling fire, clinking glasses, a couple with their back to the camera on a balcony, looking out over a glittering cityscape as the man puts his arm around the woman's waist. A schoolroom of white-shirted kids, a smiling doctor, a smiling dust-covered construction worker, a smiling businesswoman in heels, and carrying a briefcase so you know she's a businesswoman. Francesca is still. The clients sit, pale in the blue glow. Momentum.
A racing car hurtles, a footballer volleys, a boxer throws a knockout punch. A cruise ship cuts through more beautiful blue water, leaving a wake you could describe, and we have in the edit room, as classy. A helicopter banks, filmed from another helicopter. Images, one after another, quick kisses over a soundtrack that conforms to Western concepts and musical progression, but with a placeless ethnic quality that evokes nowhere specific, but everywhere that isn't here. Horse racing is happening, paragliding and quad biking and haggling is happening, wearing bikinis and big sunglasses and drinking cocktails on the netting of a catamaran is happening. Francesca speaks in the ear of the nearest client, a man with a beard. So close to his ear. When I first joined the camp, I'd voiced some tentative reservations about the state. Things I'd read about in The Guardian. The patron had seized power in a coup d'etat. Hangings in the square sort of thing. People fed into vans feet first by serious men with muted morals and, never a good sign, mirrored aviator shades. People made to kneel. Francesca liked to say that the coup was bloodless in terms of infrastructure, if not in terms of actual blood. Right, fair enough, Oliver had said. In the east of the country, there were allegedly some areas of the conflict where nerve agent was used. And so, yeah, apparently they're seeing kids born with no limbs. That sounds really, you know, not on. But I don't see how kids born without arms and legs have any relevance when we're talking about whether or not the resort has world-leading spa facilities. Because it does. It's got amazing spa facilities. So what do you want us to do? Put a kid with no limbs in the ass? We can't be putting a kid with no limbs in the jacuzzi. He'd sink. The likes of O-Dog, as he sometimes called himself, couldn't tell you where the state is on a map. Eastern Europe? Middle East? Or one of those countries floating around somewhere between Russia and China and Southeast Asia, where men wrestle bears and the women break horses from a young age? Does it even matter? You get on a plane, and sometime later, you are there. You turn on the television, and you are there. It's not like anyone is asking you to walk it on foot. So who cares where it is, unless we get into a conversation about missile range? Look, it's our job to sell the resort, Oliver continued. Money pumped into the resort will benefit the economy. Trickle down. Eventually, this will mean that the kids without limbs will get some fucking awesome bionic shit that's better than normal arms and legs anyway. I'm positive that I believe that it can happen. He put his hand on my shoulder and squeezed hard. So, if we don't sell the resort to the best of our abilities, we're actually condemning those limbless kids to a life of painful drudgery, sitting there propped up with little cardboard signs they've drawn with a pen in their mouth. We're doing it for them, dude. And if we don't do it, someone else will. The patron and the Prince of Wales went way back. School buddies. The lesson he took. First you have to make them kneel. But eventually they'll want to. Through various digital and physical materials, we present our vision, where every surface is white or silvery grey. A place to meet someone, to visit with a new love, to come in a group defined by intermingled, incestuous fumbling. Heterosexual fumbling, obviously. Food that looks amazing in photographs and is reassuringly bland on the taste buds. Cocktails with an emphasis on size, shape and colour, refracting light. A sea so bright and alive it's like electricity, crackling between two poles and you can barely look at it as you dive in. The O-Meister, as he also sometimes refers to himself, uses his Eton and Oxford education to point at these images and hit the pre-agreed talking points. The client seemed pleased. As he speaks, in that place he can't point to on a map, people are dying. People dying in places that will soon be infinity pools, swim-up bars, tasteful Italian bistro-style cafes, open 24/7 for light refreshments, concierge desks. People dying where there will soon be big inflatable swans, and ice buckets and bodies in shades of ochre, smelling faintly of chemicals. Oliver keeps pointing, glasses raised in cheers, food entering a mouth through a white smile, tactile groups around white linen, a hand reaching back to the camera, beckoning you onwards to more pleasure, more relaxation, to what you deserve, surrounded by others just like you, and not having to see anyone who isn't, to not have to know. As Francesca would say, the truest luxury is to be completely oblivious. My turn. Oliver gestures to me, and the clients look at me, and then Francesca finally looks at me, and I'm suddenly again aware of the scent of the lilies, and my desire to reward her belief in me above all else. Me. Above all else. I cough because I need to cough, but also because it feels like the right thing to do. I close the laptop in front of me. I choose the client with the beard, but only because by looking at him, I can see her too. The beheadings, I say. Oliver shifts in his chair next to me. Have you thought about selling tickets to the beheadings? Francesca remains impassive. O-Dog seems to be slowly and involuntarily expelling all the air from his body. People visit bullfights. I just figure if everyone knows that you behead dissidents, instead of trying to cover it up or whatever, own it. Make it an event. No objection. I stand and pace, physically taking control of the room through movement, the way she taught us. It's the kind of thing you could talk about at dinner parties, how you saw a bloke get his head chopped off, or a woman stoned to death. Your friends might lecture on how horrific it is, how barbaric, but you could sit back in your chair, smug, and chide your friends for not understanding the deep and ancient culture of a place they've never visited. It's not for us to judge another culture and their traditions, you say. I stand by the window, then lean against it with one hand, owning all the space in the room, and now all the space outside the room, and all the people in it. Why stop there? There are many affluent professionals here in London that will pay to be the one who actually does the beheading. After all, if we don't chop the heads off, someone else will. If you prefer to avoid personal responsibility, then maybe you could just cast a stone at a woman, along with 20 or so other tourists, and go home convinced that it wasn't your stone that actually killed her. Or vice versa. A revenue stream. A halo effect for the entire brand. An unapologetic cultural experience. I sit back down and take a long drink of water. Francesca rises, walks around the table, stands behind me and places a hand on my shoulder. I can hear the smile in her voice as she says I am one of our brightest consultants and our chief provocateur. The clients look above my head at her. I don't need to see her to know she is meeting their gaze, daring them to dissent. They're not the dissenting kind. And so she laughs, and the clients laugh, and so the rest of us laugh too. She leans in close and breathes a few words into my ear. I'd do it, Oliver says over the laughter. I killed a cow with a bazooka in Laos once. It was fucking awesome.
Our third story, the last one before the interval, will be A Queen Cannot by J.J. Surtees, read by Lynn Scossey. J.J. has published a couple of previous stories, including in Idle Ink magazine and Fictive Dream. He likes seals and is currently writing something about the Highgate vampire. Apart from her voice work in various media, Lynn helps non-actors become better communicators on Zoom and in person. She also acts in theatre, film, TV, and has recently been playing a barrister in a corporate theatre-based training program for railway track workers. They are terrified. Lynn!
A Queen Cannot by Joseph Surtees. What's this now? The doctor asks her lady-in-waiting as he leaves the bedchamber. Number 9 lost? Her lady-in-waiting confirms that he's correct and closes the door after him, leaving her mistress alone. A rare occurrence. Alone and alone, the queen thinks, and doesn't smile. She should call them both back in, she knows, reprimand them for the insult, the daring to discuss her. But she does not. She's just so tired, and asserting her authority would do nothing. You can be God's anointed and still out of his favour, a queen and less fortunate than the lowest serving girl, Queen Anne, and nothing. No screaming, no prayers to the Almighty will change this. Instead, she turns her face to the wall, welcoming the pain that comes as she moves, because it drives home to her that the little thing, her would-be loved, no, it is loved. The latest loss is not quite gone. She tells herself, sometimes, when she can bear to, that the other 8 are with her too, that they return to her. She says, when she can't be heard, they will be with her always. But more and more she finds it hard to believe in her own reassurances, this statement of their continuation in her heart. She talks to them now, not for the first time, her hands joined in front of her, but not in prayer. She can't bring herself to speak with the latest lost one, not yet, not until she has named it, like she named the others. Once it has a name, it can join its departed brothers and sisters in their afterlife, fully gone. But until then, it... the baby, she, can stay here a little, still with her for a while. They are all together, the 8 previous, when she speaks to them like this, because that's how she imagines them in heaven, together, waiting for her. The thought comforts her sometimes. Other times it makes the empty palace rooms with their gilt and gold seem more empty. I like your hair like that, she tells Elizabeth. Mine was curly too when I was younger. Oh, is that right, George? You found a beetle in your room. Was it interesting? You must take it to a gardener. They will know what to do with beetles. Always small conversations, always domestic, about their small triumphs and small disasters. She doesn't speak to them, this empty choir of the future, about how she misses them and that they do not suffice, could not suffice, against reality. No. How could she admit this to them, insubstantial though they are? She unfolds her hands. What would this one be called? She says. Not out loud. After all, who might be listening? What would her name be? Alexandra, perhaps. Is that name allowed? She wonders. Of course, she would have had to ask to discuss a name with her advisers. For a queen, the business of naming your children is not for you alone. Not that in the circumstances that has ever mattered. She remembers visiting, where? Some seaside town, maybe. There was the taste of salt in the air, certainly. And it was a fine day, so people had come out to see her carriage pass, cheer their good queen for what she had done, or they imagined she had done, to improve each hope-filled life. Yes, it was by the sea, she thinks. She recalls a stony beach, stretching into the distance, and waves coming in ceaselessly, washing everything away. Each face she saw, each woman's face, she studied, so she could know whether its owner had lost a baby, or many babies, as she had. She imagines, no, she knows. You can read in people's features, in how they are changed, penciled by premature death. Who has lost a child and who has not? She knows you can seek out and confirm loss because she can see it in her own face. It has been hardened by grief, and everyone who sees her, and she must see everyone, knows what she has let slip through her. Over time, the grief settles on your face, like it settles in your heart, in your brain, your stomach. It never leaves. Back then, she had imagined stopping the carriage and bringing with her all those in whom she had seen loss, having them, some young, some old, there with her, and asking, how did you survive? Or just, can we talk about them? But of course she did not, because that is a thing queens cannot do. Henry, have you been learning your letters? You must work hard, you know. The pressures of a prince are manifold. Helena, why the tears? Oh, you ripped your dress. Well, that's not the end of the world. Come here, I can hold you in my arms. Wipe those tears away. She eases herself up, placing her feet gently on the polished wooden floor so she won't be heard, so nobody will think to come in. I would have wanted them to dance, she thinks. Dance well. Perhaps I could have taught them myself. But again, this is not a thing a queen can do. But she is queen, so could she not have changed that? Outside the window, the gardens are turning green once more. It is spring. Yes, a minuet to begin, she says to herself. That's a simple dance. One, two, three, one, two, three. They can be partnered with each other. Four girls, four boys. But then what would Alexandra do? Sit and watch, or swap in from time to time, replacing an older sister. She starts to dance. Again, soft steps, soft. Her feet bare, graceful, placed first here and then there. Eyes watching your partner. You see, children, it is not so hard. And you look so proper and beautiful in motion. She is aware some people might cry, but she does not. How can a queen cry? If a queen cries, surely the nation will fall. Her parents taught her not to cry. She would have taught her children this same stability. Or perhaps she would not. Her dance turns her around the room in gliding curves. Alexandra would have been a fine dancer, she decides. And as she does so, she becomes aware of the latest loss drifting further away. There was a woman once, a lady in waiting, many years ago, who had been with child, then without. They had never spoken of it. Perhaps she could ask for that woman to be brought back to her. She could apologize, although a queen does not apologize, and ask for a lesson in how she proceeded with her life. No, she cannot do that. They would say the queen is going mad, and a queen cannot be mad. She kneels and holds her arms out wide. If people were to see their queen like this, she thinks. One by one, the children would come to be held and comforted. Will you have fine dreams tonight, William? On a white horse with your sword? Lie down, cast, Catherine. But don't be worried. You will see me on the morrow. What would her council say to this? Not the fusty group of old men who tell her how to run a kingdom. Her kingdom. Of it, she knows more than they. Her illusioned council instead. Those grey-faced women near the sea. Her former lady. Those who understand the form of loss and the passage through it. Would they say to let go her conversations with the dead? Forget her children? Throw away the loss? She suspects not. There is a knocking at the door. She stands and smooths down her dress. It is dark green, as if she were some maiden living in the woods. A better life? She wonders, then pushes that thought away. Come! She calls, and a man enters. A voice from the back of her skull hatefully suggests maybe it's the doctor once more, to tell her he made a mistake. But no, it's one of her advisers. White beard, no hair on his head, no grief carved into his being. Yes, she asks him. He looks at the floor and does not look at her. Would it shock him, she thinks, if I were to scream of it, if I were to scratch my face in his presence? Out with it! She snaps. She has a reputation for rudeness, she knows. Yet who can blame her? Don't people expect a little rudeness in their royalty, she thinks. To care for others' problems is not for a queen. There are affairs of state, he tells her. Your Majesty is needed. Underneath his formal words, she can hear a reproach. You have had your time for grief, he seems to say. Further indulgence is not for one enthroned. She looks back over her shoulder for a moment, then back to him. Yes, she tells him. I will be there. Lead on. I will leave this room behind.
Brings us neatly to the interregnum. This is your time to swap kingdoms for a horse, assuming you have a kingdom.
or a horse. If you can't man the barricades, man the bar instead. Just don't ask for a Molotov cocktail. You have about 20 minutes to get royally anointed. Welcome back! It's time for the infamous Lies League book quiz. Will you be crowned or dethroned? Let's intro the books.
Our first book in the book quiz is The Death of Kings, a John Madden mystery by Rennie F. 1949. An unsigned letter arrives on the desk of Chief Inspector Derry of the Canterbury Police. I have reason to believe that the jade pendant accompanying this letter is the same one that disappeared from Miss Portia Blake's body in August 1938. Since the piece could not have been stolen by the man who was hanged for Miss Blake's murder, the question arises, who else could have taken it? And why? If you like a bit of a murder mystery with vintage class, The Death of Kings is for you. Second up, a little bit of dystopian fiction, is Osiris by E.J. Swift. Book one of the Osiris Project, so if you enjoy this, there are some more, we're not sure how many. Nobody leaves Osiris. Wealthy socialite and granddaughter of the architect, she spends her time in pointless luxury, rebelling against her family in a series of jaded social extravagances and scandals, until her twin brother disappears in mysterious circumstances. As tensions rise in the city, can Adelaide and Vikram bridge the divide at the heart of Osiris before conspiracies bring them to the edge of disaster? And it is a glittering first novel, according to Adam Roberts. And dystopia is back, says SFX.
Did it ever go away?
Says SFX magazine, who should really know better. Fascinating, a promising debut. Author Pat Barker should probably need no introduction, and The Women of Troy is her latest. Luminous, says the Sunday Times. Stirring, says the Observer. Troy has fallen. The Greeks have won their bitter war. They can return home as victors. All they need is a good wind to lift their sails. But oh no. We follow the women of Troy, Helen, Cassandra, Amina, Hecuba, and Briseis, in what the Daily Express called a powerful page-turner, bringing ancient characters and stories into full colour. Skip Homer and just enjoy this epic read. Wow, someone likes Pat Barker.
Doesn't like Homer.
Screw Homer. Our final two books to win are London Lies, our two anthologies. And I should, by the way, say that if you are not Swift, or perhaps knowledgeable enough to win one of these two, other copies are available over by the bar, a mere £5. Get one for the king, queen, or revolutionary in your life. We have selected some stories which are relevant to the theme. So this is London Lies, lots of stories about London and set in London. 11 o'clock in Peckham Rye Park. Come and celebrate William and Kate's big day. I don't know, hesitated Mr. Patel, looking at the flyer. There's bound to be trouble. It will be a great day to be English, said James, and there will be sausages. And Weird Lies, which is a selection of the best weird horror science fiction fantasy, again, all read at Liars League originally and published by our partners, Arachne Press. An account of six poisonings. My sign was the pestle and mortar. My knowledge was roots and seeds, vines and leaves, bulbs and berries. I was a grinder, a blender, a crusher, a mulcher. I was a master of tubers. I mixed the tinctures and measured the powders that might cure or kill. A single grain might be the difference between health and death. Mine was a calling, a position of trust. I was the court's poisoner. So, if you're intrigued by either of those, you know which book to ask for.
Indeed. So, 5 books. We have more questions than that, just in case. But let's see if we can get it done.
They look clever.
These guys look smart.
Yeah, I think
it's almost as dark as my time as resident traitor at the Tower of London. If you think you know the answer, give us your best royal wave and yell, "Off with his head!"
Off with his head!
Shall we try it on a 1, 2, 3?
Off with his head!
Perfect, you know what you're doing. First question. Set during the 1848 revolutions, the 1970 penned novel, Royal Flash, was written by which British author?
Off with his head?
Oh, yes.
George MacDonald Fraser?
He's correct! And which book would you like?
Can I have Pat Barker?
Pat Barker.
You can, absolutely. There you go.
4 books left. If the king is in the counting house, counting out his money, where is the queen?
After his head!
Okay, pretty convincing, sorry.
The queen is in the parlour, eating bread.
It's correct!
Yes, she is!
The ancient burden, hanging out the crows, when down came a black burden. Picked off her nose.
That's the level of the
But I have dystopia.
This is not set up.
Dystopia.
Dystopia. Thank you.
You can have all the dystopia you like.
There you go.
It's about 400
pages. She lives with him every day.
Third question. Who wrote the 1908 novel concerning anarchists and anti-anarchists, The Man Who Was Thursday?
With his head.
Yeah.
Is it G.K. Chesterton?
It is! Yes. Oh, and what are the books would you like?
The Weird Anthology.
The Weird Lies.
Good choice. Award-winning Weird Lies. Ooh. I should keep reminding people. There we go.
Two books left. Which script doctor, novelist, memorist and actress is best known for her role as princess and member of the Rebel Alliance?
Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher.
It's Carrie Fisher. Well done.
You're right, they're right. Which
there
right?
There you go. Vintage classy murder.
So we have London Lies as well.
London Lies, the royal wedding story, and many more, of course.
And many more. Prince Caspian is a prince of which fictional land?
Offered
his
head.
Oh, yes. It's correct. Very well done. I don't need any spare questions. So shall we get on with the stories?
Yes!
Are you sure?
Yes!
Good. The first story of the second half will be The King's Potatoes by Jerome McFadden, read by Paul Clark. Jerome's first story to be read at Lyre's League was in February 2010, one of his first attempts at fiction. He has since become a prolific short story writer. He's an itinerant American who has lived in Paris and Singapore before nestling close to NYC. Paul is a full-time photographer and occasional actor. He trained at Central and loves storytelling, whether with words or with pictures. Paul!
The King's Potatoes by Jerome McFadden. Joachim sat in the dreary cell, waiting to be executed. The turnkeys would open the massive iron door late in the afternoons to read off the list of names. A few of the men would stand up bravely, clanking in their ankle and wrist shackles as if wanting to be done with it. tired of the agonizing wait. Others would scuttle deeper into the shadows or try to hide behind their fellow prisoners. The jailers would drive them out of the dungeon with their heavy batons. The barred windows were too high for anyone to see out, but they could watch the fading light of the late afternoon and hear the rattle of chains as the selected prisoners shuffled across the open courtyard, accompanied by shouted orders to hurry the waiting soldiers into position, followed by a beat of silence, interrupted only by the murmur of the priest. The prayers were cut short by the harsh commands of "Ready, aim, fire!" Everyone in the cell, in spite of their anticipation, would flinch at the volley of musket fire. The choking smell of cordite would drift in through the open windows, along with the sounds of mules, wagons, and work details taking away the dead. Wahim did not know how to react. When his name came, would he have the courage to stand up, to calmly say, "Si, estoy aquí, Jaim, Joachim Ibanez," and then walk through the door to his death like a man? Or would he huddle in the corner, making them come after him? None of his fellow prisoners would care one way or the other. He would be forgotten by the following afternoon, when other names were called. This afternoon, much to everyone's surprise, the turnkeys returned to the cell an hour after the daily executions. A nobleman in fine clothes strode through the door, behind them holding a perfumed scarf over his nose to ward off the stench of stale sweat from the mass of bodies, the streaks of urination fouling the walls, and the feces overflowing from the scattered buckets. The prisoner shrank away from him as he walked past them, as if he were carrying the plague. He moved slowly through the room, stopping occasionally to point at a man, saying, "Stand up." The man was slammed by the batons if he did not stand up fast enough. The nobleman would stare distastefully at the prisoner for a long moment before saying, "Stay standing," or "Sit back down." He would then push his way deeper into the cell. He had collected three men before he eyed Joachim. He no longer needed to speak. He pointed his finger, and Joachim stood up. The nobleman walked past him to select two more men. "Bring them," he finally said to the guards, turning to walk out, not bothering to look back at the prisoners he'd selected. The six trundled after him in their chains, flanked by their jailers, following him through a series of dark tunnels before entering a windowless room. That was obviously a workshop. A huge, bald man in a leather apron waited for them. One by one, they stretched their chains across his anvil, and the man banged the rivets off with a clean, brutal stroke of his sledgehammer. The men remained silent, rubbing their wrists and ankles, searching one another's eyes as if someone else might have the answer to what was going on. The nobleman came back into the workshop. He was satisfied that the chains were gone. He said, "Bender, come." They followed him across the courtyard. The king's soldiers stared at the six prisoners curiously, without malice, watching them being led into another windowless room. A woman waited for them this time with a pile of clean clothes. Other women were pouring buckets of hot water into two large tubs. "Wash yourselves," the head woman said, handing them soap, "and then put these clothes on. We will be back shortly, so do not delay." The hot water and the soap felt sensual, forgotten pleasures, like being caressed with a silk cloth. The clothes fitted more or less, and there were even boots that also fitted, also more or less. Again the nobleman came for them. Again they were paraded across the courtyard. But this time they were taken into a grand room with windows and a long table with benches on both sides. Metal plates and utensils lined each side of the table. the nobleman smiled at them, actually smiled at them, and then said, "Seat." A side door opened and a meal was carried in. Each man received a separate morsel of food. One had soup, another had broccoli, another had a slice of meat, another had a potato, another man had pudding, and the last man had a small glass of wine from an open decanter. When they'd finished, the nobleman clapped his hands and told them to stand up and follow him. He took them to a cramped cell that held 6 cots. He stepped out, locking the door behind him, saying nothing else. They heard him walking away. Every half hour through the afternoon, a guard would return to the cell, open the door to survey them, also saying nothing, and then leave. He continued to return every half hour through the evening to survey them again. They were woken at night, made to stand up, and then told to go back to bed. The days and nights followed. Eating, resting, being surveyed. Eating again, being surveyed again. They ate a few bites at most before the meal was taken away. Any effort to try for more was rewarded with a slap or a beating. They were always hungry, goaded on by the tastes and the rich smells of the food they were barely eating. The small portions, 3 or 4 times a day, did not fill their stomachs, and the tantalizing odors of the meat and vegetables and roasted potatoes, covered by the accompanying sauces, drew them into fantasies of long, succulent meals that they could gorge on until their bellies burst. And once a week, they would go back for a bath and to be given clean clothes. They finally knew what was going on. They were food tasters for the king. Nothing would reach the king's mouth without first passing through them. One night, after 10 days, Manuel Diego said, "I cannot do this anymore." Joaquim smiled. "You'd rather be shot?" I cannot stand the suspense of knowing that I might be eating poison food, that I might die after the next bite." Joaquim pointed to the door. "Then tell them to take you back to the big cell, that you can eat stale bread and rotten meat and be certain that you will soon be shot. That will alleviate the suspense." "But here, I die in defense of the king. I am here because I joined the revolution to do away with the king." Joaquin sighed. "You knew you might die when you joined. Now, if you want to be shot, that is your choice. But here, you will die clean, in clothes that do not stink. And you may even die by starvation before you are poisoned." Manuel Diego returned to his bed in silence. In the morning, there was no more talk of being shot. One day, in the bathroom, Joaquin was surprised when the woman managed to slip him a small leather pouch and a note without being seen by the guards. He tucked them into his clothes, not showing any reaction, looking blandly around him. He read the note in their small cell. It said, "The poison will be in the potatoes." Joaquim stuck the note in his mouth, chewing it carefully before swallowing. He became the potato man. He rudely took the potatoes away from Manuel Diego the first time. The potatoes were routinely brought to him by the waiters after that. The other men never questioned him, nor spoke about it. He would bite into the potatoes, desperately trying not to swallow, trapping the small portions between his teeth and his cheek. He would spit them furtively into the pouch as soon as he could without being seen, then empty it into the slops bucket back at the cell where no one would look, quickly rinsing his mouth out from their communal bucket of water. But he was becoming so hungry now that he knew he was losing his strength, slipping in and out of delirium both day and night. And then, one late afternoon, there was a hue and cry throughout the fort and castle. "The king is dead!" people shouted, "The king is dead!" The nobleman came to the cramped cell. He stared furiously at each of the six men and finally said, "I do not know how you did this, but you did. The king was poisoned from the very food you ate. You will all die for this. You will all be shot tomorrow." Joachim's five friends looked around at each other, then back at Joachim, then down at the floor. They knew. They'd seen Joachim furtively emptying the small pouch into the bucket. Everyone else had switched foods to provide a little variety for one another, except for Joachim and his potatoes. No one spoke of it, but they knew. And all five remained silent. Joachim stepped forward and said to the nobleman, "I did this. No, there is no reason to shoot these men when I am the culprit." "It does not matter. You are all going to die anyway, either by poison or by the firing squad. You may as well do it now. The cooks have already been shot." Joachim shrugged. "May I ask a favor?" The nobleman stared at Joachim in astonishment. "You dare ask me for a favor?" "I would like to die clean. May we all have a bath one more time before we are shot." The nobleman's face colored in anger, but he found the strength to calm himself and said, "You have acted bravely. I can accept that. You may bathe this evening for the last time. Then you will all be shot at dawn." They were taken to the baths, as promised, under heavy guard. They stood silently watching the water being poured into the tubs for the last time. To their surprise, the woman came back into the room with another set of clean clothes, as was the usual procedure. She gazed into Joachim's eyes for a long, long moment as she handed him his clothes. Joachim nodded to her as he accepted them, saying the words so low that no one else could hear, "The potatoes were good."
Thank you, Paul. Before the beheading, climax of the evening, some notices. You can't tax deduct hush money payments to porn stars. Sorry about that. But you can, if your name is KG Darby, run a live literary night in London for 16 years. Wow. Oh. This is the live birthday and 150th event. We'll be back at the Phoenix in 2 months' time for the 151st event. Heroes and Villains, with submissions open until the hungover street party cleanup that follows the coronation, also known as May the 7th. If you want to write for one of our other upcoming themes, including Women and Girls or Doom and Gloom, you'll find details and deadlines on the Lyre's webpage, along with a rich lineage of past events and a King's Ransom of stories. And so our final story of the evening will be We Accept Your Demands by Oliver Bussell, read by Sarah Bevers. Oliver is a graphic designer and copywriter, writing part-time from Barcelona. He's had short stories published by Didcot Press, Storgi Magazine and Reflex Fiction, and was shortlisted for the Grindstone Literary Short Story Prize and the Hammond House Literary Prize.
He's currently working on his debut novel. Sarah regularly narrates audiobooks, including novels by Philippa Gregory, Sarah Vaughan, Adele Parks, and Amanda Reynolds. She's been reading for Lies League periodically for many years, including at their online lockdown literature events. Sarah is an actor and has appeared in many theatre productions, films, and commercials. Sarah!
We accept your demands, by Oliver Bussell. We accept your demands. There is a flurry of static, and she can't be entirely sure what she's heard. She presses a button again. What? We accept your demands. You accept? That's what I said. Said the voice. We accept. Oh, she says. They accept. Wren turns to address those around her. The 15 linking arms. The group secured to lampposts with cable ties. The painted people. The tattooed man. The students glued to pavements. The elderly couple handcuffed to the railings. What? They ask. They accept, she says. Well, this was thoroughly unexpected. What do we do now, then? Asks a young girl with cornrows, who has superglued herself to the pavement. Because of her position and the already set glue, she is forced to look directly upwards. It gives her words a throwaway, wistful quality, as if she were contemplating something greater than this historic moment. I guess we go home, Fred says, the radio still clutched in her hand, index finger hovering. Let me just double check. She puts the walkie-talkie to her lips again, and the pressure of her finger ignites a blizzard of static. Just to double check. You said you accept our demands. We accept, the voice on the other end says. All of them. We accept all of them. Even the ones about telling everyone the truth and rethinking your investments. Yes, says the voice. And the ones about the food systems and the tax changes too. Oh, she says again. She turns to the group. Well, we definitely accept. How are they going to do it then? Asks the girl on the floor. Good question. She presses the button. How are you going to do it then? Well, we'll start by closing tax loopholes that benefit mega corporations while providing incentives for companies to go green, simultaneously withdrawing investments from fossil fuels and raising taxes on meat to subsidise plant-based produce instead. Then we'll inflate the cost of air travel to encourage vacations at home, making flight the luxury it once was. There is silence. And then the man comes back on. Oh, and we'll increase investment in renewable energy. Princess. That all sounded pretty good, didn't it? She turns to the crowd around her. One of them is holding a bright green flare that stutters and goes dead in his hand. That does sound pretty good, says the girl, glued to the floor. Right then. Wren presses the button. Well, you better do all of those things that you said just now. You can count on it, says the man on the other end. Most of them disperse not long after that. They move the concrete blocks out of the road. They stop linking arms, stand up, stretch their legs, shake hands, exchange contact details. Those with handcuffs retrieve the keys and release themselves. Those who have swallowed the keys take the railings with them. Those glued to the floor stay where they are until the adhesive becomes weak enough to let them leave. They will end up being trapped for a further 4 days, but people will provide them with blankets and sandwiches at regular intervals, so it isn't really all that bad. Strangers in the street applaud when they finally stand up and stretch their legs. Red heads back to her mum's place, because her refusal to partake in capitalism also includes property rental. I heard they accepted your demands, her mum says as she walks in the door. Yeah, says Ren. Thanks. She is carrying a bundle of placards under her arm and a loud halo with a red mouth. The throat is a little hoarse from shouting slogans all day. Want a cup of tea? Her mother asks. I went out and bought oat milk. Ren stares at her. Less than a month ago, her mother had ended an argument by drinking a 4 pint of cow's milk in front of her, spilling it down her chin and soaking her top. I won't be lectured on what I can and can't eat by a child! She had spluttered through gulps of white liquid. Ren opens her mouth, but finds words lacking in a space where there has always been an abundance. I'm going to bed, she says. In her room, there are unused placards in words like, there is no planet B. The time is now. Think of the children. She has the words fuck government sprayed in neon green paint across the wall above her bed. But suddenly, you feel a little aggressive. Her anger is a panicking bird against a window pane. The alarms had roused them at 3 a.m. to block off the roads before the morning commute. They prepared thermoses and enough food to last them at least a week. Beyond that, they'd rely on donations of sympathetic parents. In the end, they'd been out there for half a day. Overcome with tiredness, Ren lies in bed and falls instantly asleep. She wakes up the following morning and cannot think of why she might need to get out of bed. At breakfast, she shouts at her mum for burning the toast. I can't unburn toast, her mum says. Do I still have to call you Ren? Her mother asks some weeks later, when the initial shock of the acceptance has faded and people are back to living their now radically altered lives. Since there won't be any more protests, she says. My name is Ren, Mum. Your name is Angela, and it's such a pretty name. I'm called Ren, Mum, and there are always going to be more protests. In reality, Ren isn't so sure. She has spent several days Googling worthwhile causes, but it seems they are suddenly in short supply. Equal pay for women has been neatly incorporated into the bill, remedying the climate crisis, and even starvation in the third world will apparently be fixed when the new investment in renewable energy comes through. Endangered species are, ironically, a dying breed. Slaughterhouses are a thing of the past, and live populations are on the rise again. The government is temporarily abstaining from any unjust wars. Ren sets up a protest outside a large clothing company, demanding that they stop making throwaway fashion. Within 10 minutes, the manager of the store comes out and hands her a leaflet explaining how everything is now made of recycled hemp. For every sale, they plant a new tree. Ren reads the leaflet twice before packing up her things. It is made of recycled paper. She enters the store and buys 2 new t-shirts for herself before heading back home. She finds she doesn't really have anything to talk about anymore. Adversity had felt so at home on her tongue. She sits with friends in a silence that is only broken by brief reminiscences. Do you remember when we
through that drone and stopped the plane from taking off. Remember the confused look on their faces? God, that was a good one. They talk about communism, but only half-heartedly. It seems this new world they're living in has found an impossible equilibrium, where they can also buy fair trade trainers and electric cars if they wanted to. She wants to be angry at the establishment. But for once it appears the establishment is trying its best. Nothing boils over. They watch reality TV, so at least they can get angry at how stupid some people are, laughing at the screen and jeering at their stupid shining torsos and gravity-defying breasts. But even these apes are drinking from reusable aluminium water bottles. Some days she wonders if she is going insane. If one of the canisters of the tear gas from the protest in Paris had actually melted her brain. And right now she is laying in a hospital bed with people beside her crying, eating meat-laden lunches in plastic containers with tiny plastic soy sauce fishes and 50-centilitre plastic water bottles. They will drive their diesel cars back and forth to stroke their hair on her unconscious head and replace the flowers that are wilting and dying in front of her sightless eyes. She tries to argue with people, but is incapable of conjuring resistance. Yes, I say, I see where you're coming from. I do need to do better. It seems that everyone is transitioning to being a better person. Everyone is doing everything they can, actually. Because you were right, they say to Ren. This is bigger than anything else I was worried about before. But you didn't worry about it before, Ren wants to say. She feels as if the lines that hold her form are being erased. There is less and less to define her. The newsreader sports dreadlocks, so she cuts off her own. If she's honest with herself, she never really liked the smell of them in the summer. She begins setting fire to things. Small objects at first, like envelopes and empty pizza cartons, but then larger things like the garden shed. Her mum is angry about the shed, and so they shout at each other for a good 40 minutes. Ren justifies it as an act of self-expression that lacks any real conviction. She regurgitates facts about her generation's mental state that she'd memorised that morning. It feels good to silence someone. The two of them go to bed without making up, and Ren sleeps well for the first time in months. She thinks her mum might now be the establishment. Ren's soul has been shaped in the shadow of lunacy, her every thought braced against tides of injustice. In the face of understanding, she feels bloated, weightless. She writes angry songs and poems, but finds it hard to define exactly what she's so mad about. She has all of the beginnings, but no endings. She thinks she may have never before envisaged an ending. Ren takes to the streets again, demanding change. She had awoken in the night with a sudden clarity that finally chiselled a point to her anger, justifying her inability to feel contentment of any kind. To stop. Because people don't care. That is what she has come to realise. As much as they appear to have changed, in a moment of lucidity at 3 a.m, she understood that no one has changed at all. None of them were out there on the streets when it mattered. She knows that mum only buys local because of the judgmental whispers of neighbours. People only fly less because the prices have gone up. But mindfulness is a workplace requirement. And yoga is less effort than going to the gym. Phonies! The clarity of the thought is almost orgasmic in its simplicity. She hates phonies. Detests inauthenticity to the point of revulsion. She demands that people embrace their true selves and stop pretending. that they burn their fossil fuels and throw plastic into the sea and kick pigs to death and support child labour. They stop wearing this mask of false empathy, telling her she is right, but pretending to understand. She refuses to be fooled any longer. Her friends join her cries, clambering ashore like sailors on a turbulent ocean. Everyone is there, except for the tattooed man, who has been hired as a middle manager at Starbucks and can no longer take the time off. The loud hailer throws her words across a disinterested plaza. People don't change, she shouts atop a stone lion. People don't change. The chant takes on a mantra-like rhythm. Wren glues herself to the walkway. And although Parliament tries to contact her, she doesn't tell anyone. She's taken the batteries out of the walkie-talkie. A middle-aged woman carrying a yoga mat politely asks what she can do to change. And Wren informs her that she is sorry. But people never change.
Thank you, Sam. And with that last turn of the wheel, our revolution is at an end. You've been truly splendid. And we'd love to make you all prom kings and prom queens. But without all that messy Kerry stuff. Sorry, Kerry. Do stick around if you can while we print manifestos and argue just how far liberty, equality and fraternity will really get us. For now, please raise the Bastille, or more plausibly, the Phoenix roof, one final time for our regal authors and our rebellious actors. Good night!